be fine and then to be in Carolina in the morning.
In Carolina.
No one would be sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you'll hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading excerpts from The Southern Part of Heaven, a memoir of boyhood time spent growing up in Chapel Hill before World War I, written by William Meade Prince. Chapter 18. Love smote me unexpectedly when I was 10 years old. It happened on a summer night, soft and warm and moonless, beside Mrs. McRae's joggle board. Up to that time, I had moved happily in a strictly masculine society, experiencing little contact with the opposite sex, except, of course, my mother and my great aunts and a couple of female cousins in Charlottesville, who, strictly speaking, didn't count. There were a few girls, too, among my acquaintances in Chapel Hill, whom it was difficult to avoid at times, but they seemed almost non-existent. They appeared to be of little consequence, with no real place in the world, and we boys paid them little heed. Practically everybody had only men children, in most cases two or three of them. Just why this was, I've never even wondered until this minute. Perhaps it was nature's way of preparing for 1917. As exceptions, which proved the rule, there were two little Wilson girls, and no Wilson boys. The Venables had two daughters also, and then, much later, still a third, a great and stirring event in the community and the Venables house, but they more than atoned for this by their strenuous boy twins. On the long block which constituted most of downtown, and on which lived the bulk of my intimates, there were two Cobb boys, two Bruners, two Hurties, two Venables, two Holmeses, and one Abernathy. In only one or two instances were these supplemented by baby sisters. A trifle farther away were two Tenney and three Stroud boys, sisterless. Even the student body at the university was almost entirely male, and had been from the beginning. Only now and then did a girl student muscle in to disturb the male serenity of the university. The professors would never call their names in class rolls, because they knew that the girls, or rather the girl, might not wish her name spoken out that way in a room full of boys, and the boys always allowed her a bench all to herself, shunning her as though she were a leper. It took a brave boy to sit by a co-ed. Today, of course, all that has changed, and many hundreds of pretty girls adorn the campus and brighten up a lot of corners. But I grew up in a forest of trouser legs. I had no aversion to girls as such. It was simply that my life was so full of so many satisfactory things that there was no room for or need of girls. I hardly knew, in fact, that there were girls. That is, until Virginia Taylor came that summer, and for a brief period changed and glorified and ruined my life. Love struck me suddenly, viciously, without warning, and in one lightning flash I was bound and helpless. This has happened before to men too happy in their bachelorhood. She came with her mother from away, and, as has also happened many times before, the local boys cast their sheep's eyes at her and left the local girls swinging alone on their front gates. I had gone with my mother one evening to Mrs. McRae's. Mrs. McRae ran one of the village's most popular boarding houses. I believe they called it taking guests, however, at the time. And in the summers, when her student roomers were away, her big, rambling house was likely to be filled with people from all over, because Chapel Hill was not quite so hot as some other places in North Carolina. In fact, the people who lived in the torrid heat of the flat, eastern part of the state considered Chapel Hill a summer resort. Mrs. McRae and my mother were very close friends and co-workers, of course, in the choir and the women's auxiliary, and visited back and forth. Mother sometimes took me along, particularly if it was after dark, partly, I think, as escort, and partly that she might have no doubt about my whereabouts and doings. I remember that evening in the McRae's big yard, shadowy and mysterious under the trees. I remember the laughter and chatter and waving fans, and the dim white dresses of the ladies in the hickory chairs, and then Mrs. McRae's voice. "And this is Virginia, Mrs. Taylor's little girl. Why don't you two run and play?" And the agony of awkwardness that overcame me. I think that I said not one word during all the time I sat on the joggle-board beside her. I was extremely uncomfortable. I don't remember that she said anything, either. She was a presence, that was all. I'm sure I did not look at her face, and, anyway, it was dark. I was only aware, dumbly, that she had long, pale gold curls, and long, slim, black-stockinged legs, and a frilly, starchy white dress, and that she smelled terribly, terribly sweet. Totally unlike my boyfriend's. I think I must have feigned indifference to her, and interest in the joggleboard's bouncing, for, after a while, she rose and moved away in the dark. Afterward, on the way home, Mother asked me if I was nice to Virginia. "She's a real pretty girl." And I said, "Yes'm." But I was tormented by the fear that Virginia thought me a lout, which she probably did, and, in a way, I hated her. I couldn't put it out of my mind. In the days that followed, I suffered. I recall going by Mrs. McRae's on any and every possible pretext, usually on the far side of the street, however, where my faint heart drove me. Two or three evenings, we boys just happened to drift around and play wolf or run sheep run in Mrs. McRae's yard, for I was not the only one smitten. Virginia joined in the games, of course, but, boy-like, we ignored her, or pretended to. At times I saw her at long range uptown, but panic came, and I went no nearer. Once I slammed head-on into her and her mother coming out of the drugstore, and, in my confusion, mumbled something and brushed by. My emotions choked me, and I bled inside. I can still hear Mrs. Taylor's cheerful greeting. I resorted to love songs, the few I knew, and, when sure I was alone, hummed passionately, "When the Robin Nests Again," and "When You Were Sweet 16," and "You Are the Ideal of My Dreams," anything that had "Sweetheart" or "I Love You" in it. I sat out back of the woodhouse or in the chicken yard and mooned about her, and in my fancy wrote her the most flowery love letters. This period of torture could have lasted no longer than a week, but my condition was becoming critical when on a Friday afternoon I happened to overhear my mother casually remark that she was sorry Mrs. Taylor was going home. Going home? Somehow I had not faced that dreadful eventuality, and now here it was. The reason I know that it was Friday is that I was quite penniless, my bank empty except for my lucky piece, a big copper penny, and having just bought my bicycle, my savings account was gone too. My weekly allowance of 25 cents was not due until the next day, and my love was leaving town. I could not ask my mother to advance the 25 cents without an explanation, and I felt I'd rather die than admit what was in my mind. But I was desperate. Faster than ever I went on an errand before, I raced uptown to the express office and Marsfill. And Marsfill lent me the money. He was a man, Marsfill was, and man to man that transaction was made. I merely asked him, my heart in my miserable eyes and my voice, I guess, could he lend me a quarter till tomorrow? And with never a question, he said he reckoned he could. What a great man, what a kind man, what a bulwark in a stressful time. In my overwhelming relief, I never thought to thank him. With the quarter in my fist and music in my ears, I sped to Mr. Eubank's drugstore and possessed myself of a long, slim box of chocolate mints, just the thing, I knew, to win a lady's heart, even at the last moment. I could hardly wait while Mr. Eubanks tied up the little package, and I ignored his remark that I was spending my money like a drunken sailor. My feet scarce touched the ground on the way to Mrs. McRae's, and suddenly I stood before the door, behind which was she. My knees began to buckle then, but I knocked. The porch was empty, and the house was still. Deadly quiet, it seemed to me. It was ladies' nap time, and a sacred hour, but I hadn't stopped to consider that. Finally, Mrs. McRae's servant Mary answered, wiping her hands on her apron, and regarded me with disfavor and suspicion, chewing her snuff stick the while. With my last puff of breath and my last atom of courage, I blurted, "Miss Virginia Taylor, is she home?" "At little Virginia?" Mary inquired. "No, she ain't here. She and her mother, they gone back to Portsmouth. Left this morning." That was the end, for me, of Virginia Taylor in the flesh, and I think I have never heard her name spoken since, except in my own whisper. But in spirit, she never went home, and after that first shocked minute, when I felt so sick in my stomach and my heart, I hugged her to my bosom. She's been there ever since. For more than 40 years, off and on, man and boy, I have thought of her, although I never saw her. When I stood before her so long ago, I could not raise my eyes. All I know for sure is that her long black legs were beautiful, and her dress was white and crisp. Where her face should be, there's a blank space in my memory, framed by the long gold curls, which smelled so sweet and clean. I hid the box of candy in the bottom of a drawer, and for a long time I would take it out every now and then and turn it over in my hands and look at it. And then one day I opened it and ate the mints. Chapter 21. The Chapel Hill Volunteer Fire Department used to practice in the cool of early evening, and as the town was very proud of them, practically everybody who could wolf his supper and get uptown in time was on hand to watch. In the long summer months, with the university pretty much deserted except for a small summer school made up largely of schoolteachers taking refresher courses, Chapel Hill had little to offer in the way of spectacles, and our daily lives, indolent and easy, might have lacked for colorful excitement, except for the terrific vim and vitality of the volunteers. There was a great interest and fierce civic pride in the fire department, which, at the end of summer, and following many long weeks of struggle to attain the peak of proficiency, would go forth to the state tournament in one of the big towns, there to meet the flower of the state's hose reel teams in earnest competition for supremacy and glory. Hose reel teams from all the hamlets and villages and towns in North Carolina, maybe in all the whole country, were likewise busily engaged in drilling all summer long, a covetous eye on the glittering prize at season's end. And proud our town may well have been, for our gallant and fleet-footed firefighters won both the glory and the supremacy in abundant measure. They were our own, and we were as proud of them as ever New York City was proud of the Yankees or London of the royal family. They belonged exclusively to us, and there was nothing to compare with them anywhere in all the great wide world, we thought. About sundown, while the crowd collected to watch the practice, the young men would appear from various quarters in gym suits, the very full and flopping shorts and shirts with short sleeves, which at that time represented proper athletic costume. And they'd limber up, trotting around and stretching their muscles tenderly and cautiously, as athletes do. When the team seemed to feel they were ready, they would slowly make their way up Franklin Street, out of sight, to the starting line, which was beyond the end of the long block, the other side of Mr. Emerson's apothecary. You tried to settle down for the interminable period of tense waiting, but patience was difficult, and there was much climbing up on things and craning of necks. You always questioned the delay and wondered what was holding things up and why they didn't come, and people would say, "What in the world?" and wonder if the hose reel had broken down or the wrench was lost or something. Sheriff Suggs would waddle importantly up and down, keeping people back and the street clear, and even dogs were chased to the sidewalk and caught and held. You listened intently, cocking an ear, and waited. And then, finally, when it seemed you couldn't wait another second, you'd hear the pistol shot. "Here they come!" you'd scream at the top of your lungs, almost bursting with excitement. The falsetto din of, "Here they come!" from all the little boys in town was tremendously exhilarating, and you kept yelling it. You yelled and pushed and strained the better to see, and here they came. Doc Pickard and Brack Lloyd and Crook Hutchins and all the rest, tearing breakneck down the street in a cloud of dust, an escaped dog or two flying alongside barking frenziedly, the rubber-tired hose reel swaying and spinning behind them, and it was a fine, fine sight. They had started a certain distance from the waiting reel, 50 feet I think it was, grabbed the long rope on the tongue, and struggled into their harnesses as they ran. It was 100 yards to the fire plug by the drugstore. Frenzied moments those, while the hose was torn free, the reel spinning like mad, connection and coupling made, pressure turned on by the wrenchman, the hose filling and twisting like a snake, and your breath came back only with the water, a fine and rushing torrent, which, according to the rules, had to go 50 feet into the air. "Water! Water!" you'd yell, as the foamy stream soared up to spread in a great fan of snowy spray. It seemed as if the whole village was yelling, "Water!" Such a roar went up. It was the thrilling climax to a great show. The panting firemen would drop down on the curb to rest before emptying and rolling up their hose, and the people would swarm out into the street and slap them on the back. "You're gonna win at Asheville," they'd say, or whatever city it was which was to be the scene of the tournament. The firemen would grin and puff, while the younger spectators would wade and splash around in the puddles left by the hose, getting themselves and innocent bystanders liberally spattered with mud. The firemen would get over their panting and heaving, and push their hair back, and get up and go over to Judge Brockwell, or whoever was the official timekeeper that night, and ask how they had done. "Pretty good tonight," the judge might say, studying his big silver watch. "I can't tell exactly. Got something in my eye. But I think you did pretty good." As tournament time drew near, excitement mounted. Dark rumors indicating our certain defeat began to fly. "That crowd in Lumberton, they got a lot of ringers," or "Down in Elizabeth City, they got a reel with ball bearings." But our faith in our volunteers remained constant, and we knew that only through some sort of skullduggery could they be beaten. Slowly, their running time for the test went down. A second now, a second then, and the boys went through their drills with grim determination, knowing that they had the ringers and the big city teams, with all their wealth of material, to contend with. The day the fire department left for Asheville, the send-off must have warmed their hearts and given them just the little extra something they needed. "We ain't coming back with our tails between our legs," said Brack Lloyd. "They've got to go some to beat us." The depot and the ground around it was crowded with people and hacks and wagons. The reel was loaded in the special private car, half baggage and half passenger, which was to take our team to its test, and there was great shouting and waving as the whooper pulled out and chuffed off for University Station, where the car would be hitched onto another train for the trip to Asheville. The fire department, in its best clothes, hung out the windows and off the rear end, shouting and waving back at us. Everyone stood and waved until the little train crossed the trestle and went around the long curve out of sight. The suspense of the next 2 days was terrific, and you thought Saturday would never come. Saturday afternoon, half the town was down at the telegraph office, waiting for long hours, for no one knew at just what time our boys would run. It made your heart jump a beat suddenly to think, maybe they're running right now, maybe they're beating Lumberton. I wandered around in the crowd and asked everybody, "Heard anything yet?" Though I knew mighty well they hadn't. In my mind's eye, I saw a vast field filled with all the hose reel teams of all the towns in all the state of North Carolina lined up in an endless row, waiting for the gun. I saw them break away as the pistol shot sounded and the dust swirl about them as they began to thunder toward the faraway finish line. Dust obscured them, shouting, flying feet, confusion. And then, from out the melee, shoots Chapel Hill to take the lead. But Lumberton, its team wearing hideous black masks, is pounding just behind them, creeping up on the outside. And then, suddenly, Mr. Gooch, the telegraph operator, was standing in the door and waving a yellow sheet as he yelled in his cracked voice, "Chapel Hill, the winner! We beat everybody!" What a mighty roar went up, and backbeating and shaking of hands. Mr. Gooch was holding his hands up, begging for quiet. And finally people stopped yelling and let him speak. "That ain't all," he screeched. "They set a record!" When the boys got back, that was a time. Not only had the Chapel Hill Volunteer Fire Department won the championship, but the record which they set was not just an ordinary one. It was a world's record. That sounds as though it takes in a lot of territory, but the term was no more loosely applied than in our World Series baseball games, which, after all, only represent this land of the brave. Anyway, the Chapel Hill Volunteer Fire Department ran a given distance, dragging the hose reel behind them, connected the hose to the fire hydrant, and got water faster than anybody else, anywhere, so far as is known. Of course, there was no way of ascertaining at that time whether the Norwegians or the Chinese or the Fuzzy Wuzzies were also dragging hose reels down their streets and timing themselves, and so, lacking this information, the world's record was properly awarded to Chapel Hill. Some people claimed that the moral support given the team before it went to Asheville had helped its morale. Other people gave the credit to the testimonial oyster stew supper tendered the volunteers the night before they left for the tournament. But I think it was really neither of these influences, and that it was their own stout hearts and hairy legs which carried them to victory. All the hullabaloo before they left was as nothing to what happened when they got back. It looked as if everybody in the whole town were out at the depot to meet the train and welcome them. And when the whooper crawled in, all decorated with flags and paper streamers, you couldn't hear yourself think for the noise. The fire laddies fought their way out of the train, grinning happily, but looking very self-conscious, and some of our more enthusiastic citizens tried to hoist the boys up on their shoulders, and there was a lot of pawing and pushing. Ladies stood up in the decorated hacks and waved their handkerchiefs, and men threw their hats and themselves around. That's when Chapel Hill needed a band. We had everything else to welcome the conquering heroes, but we sure did miss the university band. We had tried to scrape one together, but the best we could do was a bass drum and a couple of horns and a fife. This band may not have played any music exactly, but it certainly made a lot of noise and added to the festivity. The hose reel was dragged down out of the baggage car, and as many of the firemen as could be perched on it were made to ride, and the crowd tied a long rope to the reel and pulled it all the way into town. That was a triumphal procession. It strung out behind almost all the way to the depot. Collier and I were up on the box with poor Dave, riding on his hack, but we decided we couldn't see enough that way, and finally got down, halfway uptown, and ran up and down the street so that we could see more of the parade as it passed by. If Chapel Hill had had a museum, I think the town would have liked to hang the hose reel up in it, and stuff the members of the team and place them around the walls. Doc Pickard told me all about the tournament later. He said the boys were mighty nervous, but when the time came, they ran the race of their lives. And he was proud to be a member, he said. He said that the teams didn't race against each other, as I thought, but only against the watch, one at a time. It just goes to show you what tricks your imagination can play on you. In addition to affording us vast and inspiring entertainment, the volunteers also protected us from the ravages of fire. But, funny thing, I never remember a fire in Chapel Hill. Surely there must have been, with all those stoves and fireplaces and tender, dry old houses. Mr. Packard's great, rambling old university inn burnt down, but that was later, and I had gone when that happened. I'm sorry I missed it. What a sight that must have been, and what a fine account of themselves our smoke eaters must have given. Every Chapel Hill boy fully expected to be a member of the fire department when he was old and big enough. It was obligatory and certain, an indisputable thing ahead, like military service in some countries, only much more happily anticipated. We began talking about breaking our own world's record when we grew up.
I'm going back to Dixie once more to see them all. I'm going to see my mother when the work's over.
In addition to the fire department, there was another cause of great excitement on Franklin Street. But this occurred at odd and unpredictable hours and was not on schedule like the fire practice drills. There was always an audience, but it was impromptu. This commotion was created by Bruce Stroud's automobile. People said Bruce was a mechanical genius, and he proved it when he was not more than 15 by building one of the first motor vehicles I ever remember. There had been a few others, of course, strange, high, horseless carriages with doors in the back and horns with rubber bulbs and lamps which were lighted with a match. But Bruce's is my first definite motor memory, because his was such a memorable conveyance. From somewhere he got hold of a little second-hand sputtering 1.5-horsepower engine. As I didn't, and don't, know anything about mechanics, half a horse was hard for me to understand, but he seemed to know what it meant. This engine he mounted on the rear end of the flat bed of an old wagon. His steering wheel was taken from an ancient sewing machine of his mother's, and this was attached to a bicycle chain and sprockets. The motor was not always easy to start, which may be an understatement, and when, after much priming and travail and tribulation, he finally got going, the noise was fearful, as the contraption had no muffler, and the smoke and smell were almost asphyxiating. But it ran, and the horses up and down the street all but climbed the trees. From far away you could hear him coming, usually preceded by a runaway team or two with cursing farmers sawing on the reins and people hurrying to see him go by. He by no means burned up the highway, and the effort and the tumult seemed excessive for the speed attained. However, if he was going downhill, the thing really rolled, and he controlled acceleration by means of a drag brake, a heavy stick bolted to the side of the wagon frame beside his seat in the middle, and which he could drag in the dirt to slow himself up. In case this failed, he could always turn into the bank or the ditch. He was not popular at this stage. In fact, there is no doubt that he was Chapel Hill's public enemy number one, and when it was seen that he could be neither controlled nor reformed, the town fathers passed an ordinance prohibiting Bruce Stroud from operating any contrivance driven by a gasoline motor upon the streets and byways of Chapel Hill. But that's as far as they went, and Sheriff Suggs never pinched him. He continued happily and freely on his explosive way, went to A&M College and studied the theory of combustion and mechanics, and following some postgraduate work in Detroit, came back to Chapel Hill and became one of those pillars of America, the Ford dealer. He has white hair now and a good reputation, an imposing establishment, and a new car or so every year. I buy my gasoline from him, and he says that for old time's sake he lets me have it at cost. If this is true, it certainly costs him a pretty penny. A few years ago, he found and bought back the first Ford he ever sold in 1914, and polishes and caresses the old crate tenderly. Sometimes he mounts this venerable vehicle and chugs around, to the great amusement and delight of the current generation. As a lawbreaker, he has few equals. The 1907 ordinance, aimed at keeping him off the streets, has never been repealed, and he figures that by now he should have been arrested about 100,000 times. But, after all, this is a college town, and the Chapel Hill police force, besides being to a certain extent helpless, is tolerant and wise. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.